And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. We both love lots of other RPGs. D&D wants us to justify all those dice we brought by rolling them at the table. Hi, I'm Ange, and I'm not really a spring chicken anymore. Maybe an early mid-fall chicken. Either way, I've been gaming since first edition, and I haven't stopped yet. I love RPGs so much, I've been writing for Gnome Stew for a decade now, and if that wasn't enough, I run the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast.
Okay, I'm Jared, Bullet Points, six editions of D&D, 182 posts on Gnome Stew, 950 posts on whatdoinowjr.com, end of line. After we look at the games that we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about the importance of being a player to keep your Dungeon Master skills sharp. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
The first edition AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide very subtly indicates that the Dungeon Masters may not want players to see the contents of the Dungeon Master's Guide by saying, "You must view any non-DM player possessing it as something less than worthy of an honorable death." It encourages you to address the real-world concept of players reading what they shouldn't by applying an in-game solution of charging them more gold for sages and taking away magic items. Using this logic, should you come into conflict with your housemates over doing chores, the logical way to address the situation is to replace their Blu-rays with edited copies that remove the happy endings to all their favorite movies.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
Okay, so the City of Cal session got canceled due to yard work. The GM and his family just put in a pool, and they are busy dealing with fencing and landscaping to make it all safe and pretty and perfect. And since the weekend we were supposed to play was actually nice, the GM made the call to cancel the game so he could focus on getting as much done as possible. Unfortunately, they still have a lot more to do because the weather since then has been crappy. So while we will still get to play this coming weekend, as from where I'm recording this, it won't be in person like we had hoped. Basically, they still have things in flux, they don't have enough done, and the house is a mess, and the GM's wife, who is also a gamer that I play with somewhat regularly, has declared that she is not allowing any other human beings in their house. I can't blame her there. I have been in that state before where it's, no, you cannot come over to my house and see the chaos. It doesn't even matter if the chaos wouldn't be that chaotic to other people. It's still, no, this is embarrassing for me. You can't come over to my house. So we will be playing online. I did get to run the old Margrave game, though. We ended up getting a little bit of a late start. Malvern's player had been off at a local spring festival with his boyfriend and lost track of time. So message that he'd be at least an hour late. And in the end, he actually didn't show up because they got home and promptly passed out on the couch because walking around a rainy spring festival all day is exhausting. I did do the typical gaming mom thing and worried about them until I got confirmation the next day that they actually were okay, and they apologize for missing things and all of that. On top of that, Dahlia's player was also late showing up, and when I messaged him, it turned out he had lost all track of time because there is too much daylight for it to actually be 7 p.m. He showed up about 45 minutes late. I was joking that he's like a dog, that like it doesn't matter what the actual time is. It's like, it's daylight. We should be doing the things. I know there are people who would hate this and would declare you should never game with people who are late, like that disrespects you and the other players. But to be completely honest, Malvern and Dahlia's players are some of my absolutely favorite human beings on the planet. I have been gaming with them for literal decades at this point, especially in Dahlia's case. And sometimes life happens. And if you care about the people you game with, you can roll with it. There is a point where you have to decide where your line is. And if these are strangers or weren't close friends, I might have had a different level of frustration. But it's not a chronic problem. It's a minor foible. And like I said, we've been gaming together for many years. And if they're late for one session or miss a session without communicating as clearly as my worried gaming mom mind would like, we deal with it. Anyway, once we got started, we were in the middle of the Honey Queen quest in the Old Margrave book, and the players entered the field of Ethel Dewanen flowers. After they entered, the pollen kind of starts affecting them, because the pollen of these flowers is what makes the magical honeys that the Honey Queen sells to the Fae, and so on and so forth. So I had all the players roll their con saves, and half of them made it, and half of them failed. The funny thing is, when I told the players that made it, that they felt like they were walking in a dream, they thought that meant they failed it. And I'm like, no, I'm just, you don't get off scot-free here. There is an effect, you just feel like you're walking in a dream. There is no mechanical effect. Relax. Meanwhile, the players who all failed got to roll on a table and determine what hallucination they were having. Grish was being stalked by a boulder that was only moving when he wasn't looking at it. Turvin was serenaded by a chorus of bees singing a dirty tavern song. And Dahlia was not wearing any pants. I think that the way they roleplayed it was pretty funny, because Grish just ran over and started beating up on the boulder for stalking him, and Turvin tried singing along with the bees badly because he doesn't know the words, and Dahlia put on every single pair of pants she owns.
I seem to recall when I ran it, we did get somebody that had the no pants hallucination as well.
Once they got past that, they were able to enter the hive proper. Mind you, they were reminded before getting to this point that they were there to save Lila, the young girl that the Briar King had sent them to find. Now, they didn't fully understand her situation or anything like that, but they knew there's a girl here that the Briar King says we should help. Now, I'll be honest, I'm not the biggest fan of this particular adventure in the book, and I'm realizing that I don't really like running dungeon crawls. I'm too interested in the story to just vibe with the procedural nature of exploring a place. I want to get to the set pieces and the cool stuff, and like having to spend all the time like carefully trying to get the information out of them of how they're navigating this place and all that is just, to me, that's frustrating. And this one was also tough because the way I ran it, the only true adversary was the Honey Queen herself. The bees themselves were mostly just following her orders and not necessarily malevolent in any way. But the way I set this up is she was, had grown greedy and possessive and so on and so forth. And I was a little worried about them engaging with it because they were kind of very wary of becoming murder hobos. They didn't want to charge in there. They wanted to do this correctly. And for a moment, they're all like, we'll just sit here in this waiting room, or we'll go camp outside and watch the entrance to see if somebody else comes. And I'm just like, I know I'm supposed to allow player agency, but oh, for the love of God, please, just, I want to get through this one. Go in and do the stuff. Thankfully, once they made their way in a little bit, they got to meet Duxt. Duxt is an NPC that is part of the Honey Queen's hive. I don't know what he is. He's a bug man. Mite person who rides around on a bee, and he thinks he's a knight. He is a knight of the bee court, and he was very fun to roleplay. So the funny thing is, like, the first person to engage talking with him was Zartath, who is the kobold wizard who has an 8 for charisma. So his charisma check to try and convince Dux that they meant no harm was bad. And then Dahlia stepped in, who actually has charisma, and she also bombed the roll. At which point, Grish stepped forward, who has just a flat 10, is your big, dumb fighter himbo man, steps up and is, hey, we're here to have an audience with the queen. We are emissaries from another king. Got a natural 20 on his charisma check. At which point, Dux was like, oh, you must be the leader, and these are your minions. Your minions are bad. Okay, let's go see the queen. At which point, like, Grish thought that was fantastic. You're my minions. So they made their way through. They got to the queen. The queen was immediately aggressive. Again, probably my desire to get this adventure over with. They had a fight with her. They had to fight some of the giant bees that she summoned. And Dux was very confused, trying to stop the fight. Either way, they took her out pretty quickly, at which point the remaining bee combatants just fled. They gather up Lila, the young girl that was in a magical slumber from the honey. They found some treasure, and they started trying to leave. On their way out, they're met by Duxt, who's proclaiming, "The queen is dead! Long live the queen!" And of course, they're afraid, oh no, we've got another fight on our hands. But that's where they got to meet the new queen of the hive, who honestly was relieved that the old queen was gone, because she'd gotten greedy and ruthless, and now they can put the hive back on track to be there for the bees, instead of just trying to make money off of Fae, trying to buy this magical sleeping honey. Whatever. So they left with Lila, and they traveled for a bit and camped out. And here's what I really wanted to get to, because I had them describe how they were hanging out at camp, what they were doing. And then, as I said, they were all sitting around the fire, not quite ready to go to bed yet. All of a sudden, Samiriza, the Irinyes that intends to be Nevrim's patron, showed up and demanded that it was time to sign the contract. And she had 6 imps with her. Cliffhanger. Basically, they're at the point where they need to level up to 3rd level. But because we're doing this reluctant warlock thing with Nevrim, this is totally stolen whole cloth from Will Ravengard's story in Baldur's Gate 3. Thankfully, Nevrim's player, who does listen to the podcast, hasn't played Baldur's Gate 3. So this is not a spoiler for him.
I was just going to ask if the 3 sisters that affirm contracts appeared there.
No, I have some imps that I wanted to have be an actual fight, and then we'll get to some of the fun story moments and all of that when we play again in 2 weeks.
I had fun with Duxt, too. The Barefolk Barbarian intimidated him, so he tactically retreated, then came to meet them again. I did like having them go through enough of the dungeon that there is a part where you can fall through the honeycomb and there's like a sinking pit of honey that you start sinking into. And just this image of 3 barefolk being trapped in honey like that was great. And the halfling trying to get them out.
They did make some comments about the old bear that guards the entrance, because he's a big old fat bear. And they're like, can he even fit through that entrance? I'm like, it's a very Winnie the Pooh situation.
I thought I was going to run 2 sessions between our recordings, but I can spend a lot of time doing campaign accurate calendars, including phases of the moon and local holidays, and I still can't read a real calendar that says, it's your wife's birthday this Thursday. My Thursday game didn't go off, but my Curse of Strahd game did.
Actually, it turned out really good that Jared couldn't run that night because I had my niece and her girlfriend in town visiting for my other niece's college graduation, and they came over to have dinner with me on Thursday and didn't actually leave until what would have been 2 hours into our session. So I was grateful that we weren't playing, so I didn't have to give up any time spending with them.
So after 5 sessions of being in the Amber Temple, they finally left. One of our players wasn't there. She was getting over being sick, but she was texting back and forth to see what was going on. And one of the messages she sent was, just get out of the effing temple, whatever you do.
Yeah, they've been there for a little while, haven't they?
They have indeed. And it's so funny because the very first time they got there, they thought they had found everything important. They're like, man, I feel so bad that we just speed run these dungeons and we aren't really getting the full dungeon crawling experiences. No, you're going to get it. It's
not this time, guys.
I transitioned to using the Taroka deck for my random encounters. You don't necessarily have to translate all of the cards literally, but twice the same player pulled the Dark Lord card as the encounter that they got. And I thought that this was a good time to reimpose Strahd as a more imposing presence. Strahd is great in Barovia because he can just like project his voice wherever, or he can show up in the clouds. Like, it is fine. He doesn't have to be there physically to cause issues. So one of these was them trying to take a long rest. Strahd shows up, and basically I was like, none of you can sleep again because you hear Strahd's voice telling you, I know that you tried to fool me into thinking that you were dead, and I know that you are alive, and how dare you refuse my invitation to come to the castle when all I wanted was to have dinner with you. And I had all of them make a constitution save and a wisdom save to see if they picked up a level of exhaustion or a level of stress. and they couldn't get their long rest in unless they tried for another 8 hours, which would have been 8 more draws of the Taroka deck to see if there were encounters. At which point they were like, no, we're gonna make do with a short rest and we're gonna keep going. I also got to try out my Bill Skarsgård Nosferatu version of Strahd's voice. Not quite there yet, but I'm practicing. Their next stop after the Amber Temple was to find the last of the gems that were stolen from the Wizards of Wine by Babala Saga, which is Strahd's childhood nursemaid. And they ended up going there and they found her hut. The hut is suspended by tree roots that like amble around and move. So it is like Baba Yaga's hut, except it's like these giant tree roots that are like moving it around.
Tree roots instead of chicken legs.
Yeah. And they went in to talk to her, and our Dampier has the noble background. So she had this idea. She's like, I'm just going to go in there. I'm going to use all of my noble charm and say, you used to work for royalty and I need to apologize to Strahd. And do you have some kind of gift that we could give to him to show him that we were sorry for trying to trick him, thinking that somehow they were going to get her to show the gem and they were going to pull off something to get the gem out of her hand. This did not quite go the way they wanted it to, because Babala Saga said, I'll let you take this to Strahd because he's such a wonderful child and you really should apologize, but I need to pronounce a doom upon you so that if you don't make it to Castle Ravenloft within 10 days, you'll just drop dead. If you agree to that, then it's no problem. And all of them were like, I don't think we can agree to this. So we ended the session with them rolling initiative. We will see how this shakes out, because Babala Saga is a pretty powerful spellcaster. And if they go outside, the hut itself also has a stat block and is a monster. So this could be interesting.
I do love how invested it seems the players are in this campaign you're running for them. Because I know they were enjoying your first run that you did for them, but this seems like they are into it.
Yeah. As much as I was trying to give them the iconic D&D experience when I was coming up with everything, this Curse of Strahd is just really hitting all of their buttons for what they were expecting out of D&D. So I'm really happy with it.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Moving on into the Dungeon Master's Workshop. One of the greatest things about RPGs is their ability to promote empathy by letting us imagine that we're someone other than ourselves. One important aspect of this empathy is for the game's dungeon master to understand what it's like to be a player at the table. Today, we're going to take a look at why those that run games should also seek to play them as often as they can. So first up, we've talked about this before in other episodes. What side of the table did you start your RPG journey on?
I was the one that had to learn how to play the game, so I was the DM right at the beginning. I was the one that stole my sister's basic set and read through it and watched someone else playing just so I could get my friends to actually sit around the kitchen table and play.
I think we're the exact opposite. I started as a player. I did not GM for 15 years. After more than 15 years, because I started in 86, and I did not run until about 2004, 2005. But I started as a player, did not run until many years later. So what was the first time you switched to the other side of the table?
I think, in retrospect, because I do think it's important for people to get that perspective on both sides, I was lucky because within about a year, my friend was interested enough that he wanted to start running things too. So we would switch off. And of course, we were in high school, especially over the summer, we would play a ridiculous number of times. So we're talking about of the two or three times that we would play in the course of a week, he would probably run once and I would run twice. But it gave me a lot more time to actually be a player. I was running in the Forgotten Realms and Dragonlance. He was running things in Greyhawk. So we staked out our own settings on top of all of that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, were you running different campaigns or were you doing the ambitious shared campaign thing?
Yeah, no, we didn't try that, but we basically were just trying to stake out whatever we could where it's like, this, we know this is my setting, so if you do something weird in your setting, that's fine. It doesn't affect what I'm doing over here. It's almost the opposite of having a shared campaign.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I didn't run until 2004, 2005, and I know I've talked about this before. It was very much, I did not think I could be a GM because I didn't know the rules well enough. the kind of social attitudes towards what it took to be a GM had a lot of patriarchy in it. I know it wasn't all that, but it was some of that. And it was very much a, you're a good player, but never a, you could run a game. And then in 2003, I got my new game group, They're 20 years old and I call them my new game group. I got my game group that I've had since then. And that one was very much TJ trying to collect people that would be a solid gaming group and could run games for him as well as him running games for them. And he was not going to take no for an answer on me running games. So that's how I ended up in the position of finally running games after being a player for so long.
As much as we have joked about the someone playing a paladin in first edition and my joke about it being you being a cheater if you actually had a paladin, I played a paladin in first edition as soon as Unearthed Arcana came out, because that was when they gave you the character generation method of, if you want to play a paladin, roll like 9 dice for your charisma and take the best 3. But what was exciting about that was they let you be a half-elf paladin according to Unearthed Arcana, which is what I played, so I didn't have to just be a human.
Yeah, we're not even going to get into the I was not allowed to play an elf because only the GM's eventually ex-friend was the only one capable of properly playing an elf. So much gatekeeping.
Yeah.
So much gatekeeping. I sometimes look back on those days and I'm like, did I have no standards? Was I just that much of a sucker for abuse? No, it was. There's still a lot of good stuff in those days, but it's usually more fun to talk about the, let me tell you about this awful thing that happened. So let's talk about, why do some people end up becoming forever GMs? What is the forever GM?
So the forever GM is that person that is always going to be the person that runs the games. Everyone just assumes they're going to be the one running the game. No one else offers to run the games, and they assume that if there's going to be a game to be done, they are going to have to be the one that organizes it and runs it and does all of that side of things for getting a game up and running.
Yeah, sometimes this is out of necessity. Like Jared mentioned, he had to be the GM to start playing at all. For many of, especially in the early days, and even today, many of the forever GMs do it because they don't think there's an alternative. If they want to play, they need to run. And there's plenty of players who are just willing to go along with whatever somebody else wants to run.
Yeah, and like you were saying earlier, some people end up being forever DMs because other people get intimidated. They think that it is a job that is too big for them. They couldn't possibly handle it. There's too much going on, so we have to leave it to them because they're the professional, because I've seen them do it, so obviously they're the only ones that know how to do it.
I had to go find a new gaming group in the early 2000s because the college gaming group I had stopped playing because the forever GM stopped GMing. There were issues with that to begin with. He was a bit flaky and would run a campaign for about 5 or 6 sessions and then flake out on it and come back a month later and want to start a whole new campaign. There were issues, but he was at least more willing to run than anyone else. What kind of problems can happen when somebody only runs, never plays? This is where we're going to get into some rants.
The first thing I'm going to say is, on the benevolent side of things, you can get a DM that just gets so burned out that they can't run and nobody can game. They never get to come up for air. It's too much for them. They just need to take a break and do something else, but there is no gaming then. So it's just nobody's gaming.
Yeah, burnout can be a very big problem for the group where only one person runs and they reach something happening in their life or just burnout on the game itself. And they just end up having to stop, maybe for a long time, maybe for a little while, but it's still a problem. On the less benevolent side, I will say most of the worst GMs I have ever had the misfortune to play with were self-declared forever GMs. They did not like to play. They only liked to GM. And most of what that proved is they were a control freak who didn't care about the player's experience, only about their fun at the table. This is my big reason of why I think GMs should also continue to play, so you can remember what it's like to be on the other side of the table.
I have had a DM who did play, but obviously he was not happy when he wasn't running. It was very much the idea that this is how the campaign is supposed to feel. If you don't make me feel how I have already determined the campaign should feel, you are playing it wrong. So it is basically that feeling that you are starting to make your players dance to your tune instead of getting to express themselves in the game.
Now, I will say, I know some GMs who tend to prefer to run instead of play, like fellow Polygamerous host Phil Vecchione. He will tell you flat out he prefers to run than to play. But this does not mean he doesn't also play, and it doesn't mean he doesn't care about the player's experience at the table. It's just he gets more fun out of running a game than just being a player. Whereas I think, like, for Jared and I think it's probably equal. We get fun, different kinds of fun from both sides of the equation.
Yeah, and I also think it's important to say, I think it's very important for DMs to play, but also I am not saying you have to play the exact amount of time that you also DM.
Right.
It may just be a matter of you need the touchstone once in a while to remember what it's like, or it may be you really do want to have an equal amount of time on both sides of the screen.
Again, saying it again, it's really important to experience what it's like to be on the player's side of the table, both from seeing how the mechanics work from the player's perspective, as well as seeing how different methods of GMing can affect how play happens. And you can sometimes get a better feel for that on the player's side of the table than the GM side of the table, because the GM side, you are juggling a dozen different things at once. You're making sure that all the players at the table are engaged and having fun, that you're moving things towards the stuff that's coming up, that you're keeping things flowing, that you're keeping things consistent. It can be very easy to miss small things that could be improved if you're only ever on the GM side of the table.
I also think if you're only GMing, it is very easy to come up with stricter rulings than if you have been a player once in a while, where you may take the strictest interpretation of something because, no, the rules say this. If you wanted to do that, you would have to do these three extra steps in order to do that. And sometimes it's worth it to do that, but sometimes you just have to relax and say, no, there's no point in jumping through these extra hoops. Or maybe I am wrong reading it that you have to do this exactly this way. And I think you need to be a player once in a while to remind yourself that,
yeah,
you know what? I haven't let them do anything that feels like a success for a long time, and you need to feel that when you're a player.
So let's talk about some specific things we can learn as players that can improve the games we run. What is it we can get from being a player?
I've heard a lot of people talk about how being imaginative with boundaries is sometimes more fruitful than just saying you can do anything you want. And I think it is good for your imagination to picture the world through the lens of just your character instead of being the one that can say, dragons showed up and destroyed the entire kingdom. When you have
rocks fall, everyone dies.
Yeah. When you have that constraint of you are going to be your character and there's lots of things you can do with your character, but it's all from that character's perspective, it triggers a different part of your imagination.
I'm going to say something that might come off as a little awful. Many of the skills I have tried to develop as a game master are in direct opposition to bad GMs I have played with. I have learned a lot on what not to do in various games I have played over the years. Now, I will say most of these were con games where it was 4 hours of my life and then I could move on. It wasn't a campaign. There's only been one of those campaigns, but a lot of the good stuff I have learned is in both seeing what to do and what not to do. Because I will absolutely steal stuff from a GM that does something really well. There's a GM I played with very early on that I have some issues with his GMing. I don't seek out his games anymore. But he is so good at getting new players immersed in the game. And some of that is the descriptions, the way he goes to the character, pulls them into the narrative of the game. Those are some primo skills. But I also learned from him, be very careful about your NPCs. Don't make them all the same. Make sure you're varying up the settings we used. I was in Captain America Winter Soldier watching it. And when Cap and Black Widow go to the World War II bunker, where they find the Hydra stuff, that was, I was in the theater with a friend of mine who has also played this Game Masters games, and I lean over and it's one of his games, because we have gone into so many World War II bunkers that somebody had lost track of. I get it. There's some cool things we really like using, but playing with other GMs, you can start to see some of those kind of pain points and start trying to recognize them in yourself. I have very much realized I need to be careful with carnivals and amusement parks. I love them as a setting for a game, but I have done it often enough that I ran one for a friend and he's, oh, I played this game before. And I'm like, no, you haven't. And then I realized, no, he played the other game that had a mystery magical carnival in it. So it's, oops.
What's funny is when you mention conventions, my first convention was right after I got out of high school, and having my friend run games was great, but to a certain extent, because I was the first one in our group to run, he picked up some of his GMing from how I GM. No matter what he read in the rules, some of it was based on what we were collectively doing. So that convention was the first time I got to see other people running a game that did not come from my thought process, that weren't anybody that was aligned with any of my games. And I got to see the highs and lows in that very first convention, because I had a GM that actively encouraged me being ridiculously over the top as a bard, which I was amazed that I did that as my first time at a convention. Everyone else at the table was dead quiet. I'm playing a bard. I'm like, I need to get this party rolling. So I started instigating everybody at the table. And after I started instigating, everybody started role playing. It was great. But the GM rolled with that. The next session, I had the GM that would do things like, I'm going to hit it with my longsword. And he said, you missed. Why did I miss? I haven't rolled to attack yet. Because you didn't say you entered the room. And I was like, so you're saying, because me, the player, didn't tell you I entered the room, my character, who is a trained fighter, stood here 15 feet from the person and swung my sword. Yes, because you didn't say you entered the room.
This gives me the opportunity to say my mantra, respect the competency of the characters.
But it taught me, like I said, multiple different types of GMing that I had not encountered before, because I had only played with my friends up to that point.
When I got back into gaming in 2003, it was the worst game master ever. Absolute horrible. But the other players, I liked the other players. So I stuck it out. And then I went to a con. I found out there was a convention in town. And I went to the con, and all of a sudden I was playing games that didn't suck. And I could not go back to bad GM game. Thankfully, the other players fled with me. And in, I think that was November of 2003, by January 2004, we had formed our whole new group and were off and running playing. You learn a lot from both the good and the bad. What is something else that you have learned as a player that helped you be a better GM?
The funny thing is, I hate to say it this way, there are a lot of things that you learn in the negative by seeing things that you're not happy with on the player side of things. And I want to emphasize, this is a positive experience for the most part, but there are times when you will see things, this just is not how I would do this, and this kind of bothers me. And one of those things has been when I see a GM that gets so hyper-focused on that one player that is more vocal than everybody else, and that one player is doing everything, and I never get a chance to do anything with my character.
Yeah, spotlight management is one of those things I was going to bring up, because as a player, I know when I am getting my opportunity to speak. I also can see when other players are either not, or when they're steamrolling other players. Having that experience as a player after having run games allowed me to be like, oh, this is what I need to be on the lookout for when I am running the game. there's a couple of variations on this. The domineering player, they're always the biggest voice in the room. They're trying to push things forward. Sometimes they're not bad. Sometimes they're just steamrolling the other players. The other problem player is the teleporting player. It doesn't matter what's going on. When the GM shifts their focus to somebody else, all of a sudden that player is there. And I have been the player to be like, stop it. You know, because the GM's got so many things going on. They didn't catch it happening. And I'm like, stop it. You are not there. This is somebody else's scene. Give somebody else a chance to do something without you having to be immediately involved. The GM told me afterwards he wanted to applaud me, but he figured that would be rude. So it's the learning that spotlight management, I think, is requires being on both sides of the table at different times to see how it works from both perspectives. Because when you are on the player side and you can see the GM having issues with spotlight management, if it's purely benevolent, if it's not something they're doing intentionally or callously, you can do things to help pull in the players that are getting left behind or not in the scene. Whereas once you've done that as a player, you can be on the GM side and be like, okay, I need to make sure I check in with everybody, that I make sure everyone is doing something in this scene.
On the positive side, I will say that I have learned from being in other people's games, especially like early on, letting a scene breathe, because I was very used to this idea of, I'm going to ask you what you're doing. That's what you're doing. Okay, cool. Now let's go to the next person. Now let's go to the next person. Okay, now let's roll initiative. And that's great to keep things moving sometimes, but once in a while, you need to let things breathe. And it was once I was with other GMs that I saw, oh, he's just sitting back and letting us talk to each other in character and letting this build up. And now it feels like we didn't just come up with a plan as players. We came up with a plan as characters.
I still struggle with this as a GM sometimes, especially when it's not necessarily the whole group with each other. If it's the whole group interacting with each other, I can just sit back, let them roleplay, take a breather, whatever. But if it's these two players having this scene while everyone else is waiting, those I start getting nervous about. And I want to let them have their scene. I want to let it breathe. But I also need to get back over to these players. And I have been asked by my players, let us roleplay. Okay. I'll do it. I'll try and be better.
And another thing that was interesting, growing up in that era where I am reading Gygaxian prose on how to run D&D, there was this feeling like, when I'm running, I need to be serious. This is the story we're telling. I'm the GM. I have a certain role here. Sometimes I can show emotion because I am playing this NPC or that, but mainly I am presenting the game world. I am the judge. I am absolutely true neutral in all things. And seeing other people show enthusiasm when they're running, like letting you know, I love role-playing. I love running games. And seeing that sometimes is, oh, wait, maybe I should be doing that more than trying to sit here and go, no, I need to curb my enthusiasm and just do things exactly as I am supposed to be doing.
We'll get to some of that in a moment. But first, I want to ask, have you ever been the problem player at a table because of your DM experience? Because I know I have.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I have. Most of the time, I will bite my tongue and not say, that's not how that rule works. There are some times when it's, oh, this seems really important. This seems really important. It's just shut up. Nope, I'm going to say it. And the other thing is, like, in organized play, there were a few times where I don't blame myself, except that I went into organized play as a player and I shouldn't have. But there are times there where it's, no, this is not how the scenario should be going. I've run this before. This is the type of thing this should be. And I try not to do that. But there are also times where I'm like nudging other players and saying, you shouldn't be doing that. He's leading you in the wrong direction here and it's going to screw you over. Stuff like that. It's, I shouldn't be doing this, but they're annoying me so much that I can't help it.
I will say that in general, if I am getting annoyed when I am a player, I'm not fun to have at the table. I get snarky. I get surly. It's not good. I need to develop some skills at regulating my emotions in those moments. But I have also found myself being the backseat GM, especially if it's somebody running a game that I know and they're not doing it correctly. And I say this as somebody who like ignores the rules all the time. Heck, we were having a conversation about a game I'm running the other night, and I was like, yeah, I'm the GM. I have no idea how that works. I say this as that person, but I did this especially to a friend who was running a Powered by the Apocalypse game, and they were doing it wrong, and I was just like, that's not how that works. This is not how you're supposed to do that. And then in another game, I had a situation where I made a character, and in the second session, I missed the second session, but a new player joined. And then the third session, I found out the new player had basically made a character themed exactly the same as mine, but even more weird and better. And I was so angry at that. So angry at that. And I'm like, I'm a GM. I know how it goes. The players want to make a character. You're not thinking about it. You let them make the character. Not completely attuned to the fact that's going to be stepping on this other character's toes. And yeah, I have been the problem player.
Oh, good. I remember when I was in a 4th edition game and my paladin got completely upstaged by someone bringing in a fighter that was using the first martial supplement that came out, which made them a much better defender than my character could ever be within like 6 months of the rules coming out. And I'm just sitting there seething because it's not your fault, but also I am mad about this.
One of my first experiences with Tristan, who runs the City of Cowls game, was a D&D game he ran at a small convention where I met him. And I chose the ranger because I wanted to be the kick-ass archer. His cousin made his own character to bring in, which was better than my archer times 10 because it was made with several different splat books and a prestige class and all these other things. And I was just like, you're lucky I like you so far, but this is a black mark. This is not a good thing. Luckily, we all worked it out, and I didn't stop giving Brendan crap about that for years.
I think this is another thing that I was thinking of that is, it is GM related, and that is that I see so many different games and so many different mechanics that there will be times when I see a mechanic that I don't like. And I will get into the weeds of talking about, I don't like games when they do this because then it interacts this way. And it's, don't have mechanical discussions in the middle of the game like that because it kills everything. It brings it to a screeching halt. And I think people that are regular GMs are more likely to know about multiple systems and do that kind of comparison where, oh, this works this way here, but it doesn't work this way here. And I wish it did. Even if you're going to say that, say it and be done. Don't keep talking about it.
What can we learn from playing other game systems other than the one we regularly run?
There are a lot of things that you can learn that even if you don't bring the rules in wholesale, you can learn from the procedures and the common things that happen in those games.
What you were talking about before, about how you felt you had to be stone-faced running a game, and then you went to cons and started playing with other people and saw people running games that were actually enthusiastic, that makes me think of the Powered by the Apocalypse edict of be a fan of the characters.
Yeah.
That is so part of my ethos as a GM. It's like, I am here for them to have the most awesome story possible. To have the player to have the best experience and that character to be epic. I want to be here for that. You can learn a lot of these philosophies from other games, even if you don't learn the mechanics.
Mm-hmm. There are even things about like exploration and how time passes and having a procedure that the players understand so that it's not just this kind of boring, what do you want to do? And then if you don't know what the procedure for these things are, you just all sit there. But knowing to lay out to the players, if you do this, then it leads into this phase and it leads into this phase. Playing some like older school exploration type games gave me a lot of ideas for how to do things in 5e where I'm not going to do it the exact same way, but it does tell me you need to have steps that are clear and transparent so people don't just think this is open-ended and they're going to have to tell you every step that they do as they walk through the wilderness for 2 hours.
There are a lot of people who are resistant at trying other games because they're worried about not being good at the mechanics or struggling to learn how another game works. So 5th edition is very much based on the bones of every single edition that came before it. But there are also ideas in 5th edition that came from other games. It very much took some of these ideas, and it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't direct mechanics. It was more ideas that they pulled in to try and create the game that became 5th edition. And understanding a lot of that can help you be better at adapting your play when things come up that aren't actually covered very clearly in the rules. Or it gives you more tools to, like, I don't want to take the time to dig through the book and find out how to actually do this, so we're going to do it this way.
What's interesting to me about that, I remember early in 5th edition when people were reading that if you have inspiration and someone else doesn't, you can give them your inspiration. And I had people at tables going, I don't like that. That doesn't make any sense. It's already a meta currency, and now it's even more meta. This is just complete gamers bullcrap. I hate it. And from playing other games, my first thought is, yes, you can give them your inspiration. I do want you to tell me, what did you do to inspire them? What did you do to help them?
Yeah.
Like, mechanically, it's fine, but I just want some story to go with it.
Let's pin a topic on metagaming, because I have thoughts, and I know there's a lot of people out there in the community who think all metagaming is bad. It's not. It's necessary.
It is not.
But we're gonna pin that particular topic. How has your time running games improved your skills as a player? We already talked about how we can be the problem player because of GMing, but how has it made you a better player?
There have been things that I see people do with their characters that I would have never thought about, but the next time I make a character, I start looking at some of the things that they did. And I know it's going to sound more mechanical, and sometimes it is, but it's not so much about maximizing your damage as much as it is, oh, that is a cool ability that I never looked at if I take this one subclass. And I really like being able to do those things. Oh my gosh, I love my Grave Cleric that I was playing, but I would not have known about how much I was going to love Grave Clerics unless I was running for people in Adventurers League that started using Grave Clerics. And then when I was playing, I'm like, I love this idea, because as soon as somebody gets a crit on them, I can point and say, no, you're going to live. And then it's not a crit anymore because I can cancel those out as a Grave Cleric. I loved that feeling, and I wouldn't have known about that unless I had seen people actually playing those characters. So it opened my eyes to a lot of options that I wasn't thinking about.
For me, one of the things it taught me is how to be the type of player at the table that is a boon to the GM instead of a bane to the GM. Like on Misdirected Mark, they've talked before about Rainmakers. I have a problem with some Rainmakers because some Rainmakers just give me a headache. A Rainmaker is the player who just gets in there and does stuff. And sometimes that can be awesome. And sometimes it can be a real pain in my butt as a GM because, like, it's taking things in a way that I didn't expect things to go. It's taking things away from the focus on other characters. It's taking stuff away from the stuff I have prepped. Sometimes it's just chaos for the sake of chaos. And I don't enjoy that as a GM, so I try not to be that as a player, but I still try and be proactive and do stuff to keep things moving. And because I have run, I sometimes have a better sense of where the GM is expecting or hoping things will go from here, and I can try and lean into that. None of this, we're going to sit here in the waiting room to see if anybody else comes by. No. As a GM, I know that's not what is supposed to happen here. So let's keep moving.
I've definitely learned to help with the spotlight management. And sometimes it's even been, it's not so much me stepping into the GM's role and saying, wait, you should talk to this player. It's me as a character saying, I am really interested in finding out what you have been thinking about, cleric that is my best friend. And pulling them in so that their opinion is coming in, because I just happened to get that spotlight for a second and realize they have not had it for a while.
Yeah, it's very much you as the player can use your power for good. You start pulling in the other characters. Don't go off and do something alone unless it absolutely makes sense and other people aren't being neglected. If you're going to go do something, drag somebody else with you. If you're going to go do shenanigans are more fun with a friend, so bring a friend along.
Speaking of friends, that's another thing that was interesting, because I think as a DM, you're used to looking at, like, storytelling tropes and, you know, how characters react and everything. when you're a player, a lot of times you're thinking of your character. And even if you're thinking everybody else in this adventuring party is my friend, it doesn't always come out. But a lot of times what I have done is if I notice that one player and I, our characters have been working together a lot more than somebody else, I will start specifically acting like this is their friend that they have been in this situation with and referring to things and building out that relationship a little bit more.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Nograt.
When we had 8 players in our Prince of the Apocalypse game, the Wood Elf Monk and my Grave Cleric were like best friends because we were the two that would stand back and go, I am really scared that the rest of these people are going to get us all killed. We might need we may need to knock them unconscious and drag them to a town to let them rest because they aren't even thinking about that right now.
I really enjoy the dynamic we had between Nograt and Sapphire. Yeah. That was a lot of fun.
It was. And I think that's not that you shouldn't have friendships with everybody in the adventuring party, but there are like those natural bonds that form between certain characters. And I think you should play those up.
Yeah. You want to be careful that nobody's getting neglected. Nobody's getting left out. But it is absolutely a blast to build up those friendships with other characters at the table. In the City of Cowls game, Dove is fond of everyone else in the party, but she is closest with Anu. Her and Anu have a bond. It makes things a little more special as Anu rescues Dove when she accidentally turns herself into a potted plant, and Dove keeps trying to make sure Anu doesn't lose the rest of her soul in her fight to kill Asmodeus. So there you go.
I also think you learn to ask questions. Like, I think this flows both directions. The more you're seeing things from the player's side of things, the more you think about questions you wish the GM would ask you. So when you're the GM again, you think more about, I don't just want an answer from you. I'm going to ask you these follow-up questions so that we're getting texture and detail. It's not just, I want to do this thing. It's, I want to do this thing because of this. And also, I want to follow up with this, or I want to make sure that this person is also helping out. Learning to ask more questions, I think, comes from being on that player's side sometimes.
Yeah. Have you ever had one of your players take the leap from player to DM? And how has your experience on either side of the table helped them?
I am going to bring out the ones that I am proudest of, because I ran D&D for 3 of my kids when they were younger. All 3 of them still play D, and 2 of them have had their own games that they have run for other people. And
that's
I am
awesome.
So glad to know that's the case. Like, I'm happy for the one that is still playing that doesn't want to run games too. Don't get me wrong. But it is very gratifying to see them take things and run with it and realize that they want to run a game and provide this experience for other people too.
Yeah. The most recent one for me is Les. Les stepped up to run Kitty Catter's game where we were D&D characters based on our cats.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot of fun helping her kind of take the step from being, she'd run stuff for her friends, like little one-shots and stuff. This was her first time stepping up and doing a campaign for us. And I really enjoyed helping give advice and guide along the way and answer questions. Because there were things like Les had a plan and then rushed through the plan in the first session. And when that was done, she realized, like, if she didn't fix the plan, we would be done in a session. So it was like, oh, okay, I need to, A, slow down, learn where to give breathing room.
Yeah.
And B, bulk things up so that this is actually more of an epic journey. And it was fun being a player and kind of an advisor for that game. Wrapping things up, if you had to recommend one single thing, what would you tell DMs to be on the lookout for when they're on the player's side of the table?
I would say, even though you deserve to be awesome with your character, look for ways that you can support other players, because when you're on that side of the table, you are modeling the behavior, and that will get everybody looking for how they can make everyone else look awesome. And when everybody's looking out for how to make everyone else look awesome, it just is a chain reaction between everybody at the table.
I would say take the opportunity when you're on the player side of the table to A, relax, just enjoy.
Yeah.
And B, pay attention to how things ebb and flow on the player side of the table, because that can help you understand things when you're back in the GM seat running the game. There is an importance for both running and playing games. And I do think I'm not going to force every single player out there to run a game. But I think any player who is really, truly invested in this hobby should try running at least once. A, it'll give you some respect for the work that the GM has to do. It can help curb some of those chaos gremlins that give GMs a headache because they don't have any respect for the work and effort you put into a game. And it can really, or it could just create a monster. I don't know. we're looking for the bright side of things here. Do both things because both things are awesome.
And I'd also say, especially since we're talking about D&D, you can look for things like layer books or adventure anthologies so that you're not running a whole campaign. Here's a thing you can run in one or two nights to give you the feel for whether or not you are comfortable doing things from that side of the screen.
And the last thing I'll add, especially you forever GMs, nurture the players in your group to become GMs. You will alleviate a lot of your own stress. You'll help build a better, more solid, stable gaming group. And creating more GMs is never a bad thing.
Now let's join Ange and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to the listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. But first, our Eldritch Invocation. We have a Patreon now, so if you'd like to help us do the show and provide some additional content for you, we would love it if you decided to join. We've got our own Discord, and we'll be releasing additional supplementary material, which could be stuff that has to do with our actual play. Chris has done a lot of things like the NPC classes. I have done things here and there about lair actions and things of that nature. We have additional spells that we have made up. You never know what you're going to get unless you invest in being our patron, and then we will Eldritch Blast for you. So you can
find Eldritch Blast you.
No, we'll Eldritch Blast somebody else that you want to point us at.
Yeah.
Perfectly okay. Yeah, in fact, get on the Patreon, leave us a message to say who you want us to Eldritch Blast. We'll definitely take it under consideration. And that Patreon is at patreon.com/thack0wa.
So if you weren't aware, Daggerheart has been released. This is the game by Darrington Press, created by Spencer Stark and made with Critical Role folks like Matt Mercer. There is a YouTube interview by Bonus Action with Matt Mercer and Spencer Stark about the game, and I thought it was pretty fascinating to hear them talk about why they made it and what their goals were. Specifically, how they were looking to create a game to support the heavy narrative games they love and we see in Critical Role episodes, but also still lean into the mechanics that support minis and other fun tactical play like that. There will be a link to the YouTube episode in the show, and you can find out more about Daggerheart at daggerheart.com.
And since we're actually kind of excited about Daggerheart here, not only is Daggerheart here, but they're already playtesting new material. There is a section on the Daggerheart site called The Void, which has playtest material for the game. Right now, they are playtesting a Warlock class, which has the Pact of the Endless and Pact of the Wrathful subclasses, and the Fighter class, which has the Juggernaut and Martial Artist. And when I say fighter, in this case, this is not like a D&D fighter. This is like someone that fights without weapons, that uses their body. So the Juggernaut is somebody that's more barreling into people and throwing them around, whereas the Martial Artist is the more precise of those two. So we'll have a link to The Void in the show notes, because who doesn't need a link to The Void?
We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast like
The Heroes of Hobble's Way. The Heroes of Hobble's Way is an epic fantasy story about two young heroes, Odie and Aramon. These heroes have the potential to deal with a dire threat from an ancient time that is poised to return to the world. A Titan Destroyer, Valhel Morris the Mountain Strangler, stirs. The fate of the Barony of Castakin may be in their hands. We play the game to find out, and we invite you to join us on this journey.
We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.